I'm Zach. I'm a musician, a former worship leader. I help destroy megachurch. I'm barely getting through this. And help destroy megachurch. And I'm not really sure what I believe anymore.
Dave, sometimes preacher, Bible, movies, evangelical.
Sorry, Dave, what's that? You said you're an evangelical? Yes. welcome everyone to Djembe Talk.
Is that a djembe? You really pulled out the djembe for this?
It definitely is.
Great.
Veterans of Culture Wars is a podcast where we talk about the beliefs, history, culture, and personal stories from evangelical Christianity. We welcome you to the podcast, whether you are a believer or not. And this episode is one that we, Zach and I, have been wanting to do for quite some time. We have wanted to talk about purity culture and the impact that that has had. That's a big part of evangelical Christianity. If you grew up in the 80s, 90s, well, beyond that even too, the aughts. So we have definitely wanted to talk about that subject, and we have a guest here to do that with us.
Yeah. Megan Crozier, she co-hosts the Thereafter podcast with Cortland Coffey. She organizes a deconstruction book club, writes about faith deconstruction, spirituality, equity, justice, race, mental health, purity culture, and more at her site, thepursuinglife.com. when she is not tweeting as at The Pursuing Life. Welcome to the show, Megan.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And when you're not, you know, practicing the djembe, of course.
Oh, man. Do we need to give some context for your listeners?
Yeah, like I think, well, we were listening.
We need a little bit.
If you heard our episode with Jazz Robinson.
It was amazing, by the way.
Maybe
Love
a
Jazz.
Month ago or so. Yeah, we had a brief aside talking about like how weird it was when churches got super into like African children's choirs and the djembe, and Megan heard that and she felt seen, and she remembered her days as a church djembist.
Seen, maybe called out, I don't know.
And you know, there's nothing wrong inherently with the instrument. It's fine. It did feel a little silly. All of, you know, a lot of white folk with holding this kente cloth wrapped instrument, you know, slapping skins for God. We had a little back and forth about that. I think it was cathartic. It was helpful for you to get that off your chest, to admit.
An epic Twitter thread.
It was a fun day.
How long has it been since you played the djembe?
Oh, wow. 10 years, maybe 15. I don't know.
Did you play any other instruments?
No. I mean, I had a brief bit with the piano when I was young, and that's kind of my party trick. I can sit down at a piano and play The Entertainer, like just bust it out from muscle memory. And that's it. That's all I know about the piano. But yeah.
little Scott Joplin action there. There you go. I think that's maybe that was my issue with the djembe in church, was that it was clear that it was usually played by people that didn't play any other instrument. And so somebody was just like, we need some extra hitting things.
I just wanted to be on the stage, I think.
Sit here.
And I couldn't sing. So I was like, give me something to bang on and I will be there like with everyone.
Yep. Yep, they're like, tambourines aren't cool anymore, so we're all going to djembes.
Speaking of your time playing djembe in evangelical worship services, do you want to share a little bit of your background with evangelical Christianity?
Yeah, so I grew up, as a lot of us did, in an evangelical church. I grew up in the Midwest, so in Illinois, we were largely modeled after Willow Creek, if you've heard of Willow Creek.
Yes.
That was our church leadership would go to their conferences and We had, you know, drama that in the Seeker service, if you remember that era of things. But so I was just, I'm an Enneagram one, which if you're not familiar with Enneagram, I like rules. I like right and wrong and just a clear sense of that. And so I just really was all in, you know, give me the rule. I will follow it. I will do the thing. So I was a student leader in youth group and then went on to Christian College. I went to North Park University in Chicago, which is affiliated with the Covenant denomination. I wasn't Covenant, but it was just kind of a more, I guess it was considered more liberal than some of the other Chicago area schools like Wheaton or Moody. So, And I studied youth ministry in Spanish and signed a pledge that I would be a missionary someday. Never did that. Thank goodness.
Did you have an idea of the country that you maybe wanted to go to?
Yeah. I scouted Ecuador. I went out for a conference and I even had a guy that I thought probably I would marry if I lived in Ecuador. It was the whole thing. Didn't happen. But anyway, so after college, I went through kind of one of those bits that people have where they call it their maybe quote unquote rebellious phase where they might like walk away for a bit. And I had a couple years of that and had my first Mike's Hard Lemonade, kind of went from purity culture to hookup culture and just kind of had like a couple years where I was had some experiences in college that left me a little bit burned. And then I had this like reckoning where I came back and was like, oh no, that was like this awful time of garbage in my life where I walked away from God. And so then I went back to church and I was kind of navigating. I was like substitute teaching and waitressing and really just a little bit lost. And so I went back to school. I was getting my teaching degree and went back to church and met my husband, converted him to Christianity. And
I was a missionary,
yep. And then I became a teacher. And for a long time, I was just kind of in this evangelical world. And when we would move around, we moved from the Midwest to the Pacific Northwest. That's where my husband was from. We would always get involved in a church. That was how we found community. We'd join a small group. We would, and we were just really, we would always find our good friends there. And then fast forward to a couple years ago, it was just started to become, I started to have some deal breakers that I realized were not the same as the people that I was surrounded with. And I think it kind of coincided with the pandemic and I left my teaching career at the same time too. And so, and I just started expressing all of it online. And so if you follow me on Twitter, you see that I say the thing, I just kind of live like that. So, and that's where I'm at now in kind of full blown faith deconstruction. So here I'm at.
So you're relatively newer to that. That was, you said at the beginning of the pandemic is when there's probably always been questions, but those questions became something where you started to rethink like your faith and how you saw the world and all of that.
Yeah. So I will be honest. When we started the pandemic, I was like praying every day, reading my Bible every day. I was like, God is going to get me through this. I'm going to, you know, and I think it was kind of a catalyst, but, and I was going to online church every single week. I was doing online book clubs through church and stuff like that. So yeah. And so I started deconstruction during the pandemic. And I think that does surprise people because I think some people think I've been doing this a little bit longer than I have. And I think there's been pieces of things that I've pushed back on, but I think part of it, and I didn't mention this, but part of it is during that time, I also wrote a memoir. It's very evangelical. It was like these prayers that I had prayed in college. I had prayed for an hour a day for a couple of years in college. And I was kind of tracing the arc of those prayers for 20 years later into from college to COVID. And as I wrote through my life, it was super healing for me, but also I started to come up to things that I was like, man, that's super fucked up. Like, what? And so I finished the book and it was like this, I wrapped nicely with a bow. Like I, you know, I did all the things. People loved it. My family loved it. I had it pitched to Zondervan by a networked Christian author that I know. And it, that didn't work, thank God. But I think it just, once I started writing through, I realized like, okay, I have a lot more to process here. And then I started to kind of realize what deconstruction was and realize that that was the term that really described what I was kind of figuring out.
When was the last time you read any of that book?
My own book?
Yeah.
It's
I don't know
hard.
If authors go back and read their own books. I listen to the music that I make because I like it, but it takes a lot longer to read a book. I don't know. I'm just thinking. So I have a cousin, one of my, you know, like second cousin or something, whatever you call it when it's your cousin's kid, who's like, who finished, she got married young. She's very evangelical. And like immediately after getting married, she started working on a book about marriage, like an advice book. Mm. Because now that she's married, she knew everything.
Yep.
And like by the time she published it, like within months, she got divorced. Mm. Is still super evangelical and definitely not vaccinated, even though her brother died of it. Now I kind of want to read her book. But I don't know. It's gotta be wild to write a book and then learn some things that really challenge what you thought originally. But I think maybe in her case, she probably fully supports everything she wrote, and maybe it's just wrong guy. I don't know.
That is just all around super sad. Wow.
And there have been times where I've thought about like deconstructing my memoir and like releasing a chapter at a time with like commentary, kind of like mm-hmm. Mystery Science, but like in written form, you know. Yeah. But I also have reflected and just thought like there was something to who I was then. And I, you know, I'm trying to figure out how to honor that person while still honoring the person I am today. And so it is kind of wild and it is hard to look back on, but I've also, it's a journey. Life is a journey and I'm just a traveler on it. And so I'm learning as I go. And there were things that I did not know and things, you know, we're talking about purity culture. There were things about how it had affected me that I did not understand. And as I've learned and unpacked the harm, I'm like, okay, this was that, you know, and I didn't know this, but here I am.
Real quick. You mentioned drama with the church that you grew up in. And I wasn't sure if you meant like the drama department, like you were involved in like the musicals as a kid for like Christmas or Easter or whatever. Is that what you meant? Cause if you were in one of those, I want to know which musical you were in. Cause I likely am familiar with it. My parents had a business selling these musicals to churches all over the country and around the world. So I listened to them in my spare time as a child. That was my fun music.
No, I'm sorry to disappoint you. I was a theater kid, but what I was referring to was they had like skits that would be like mm-hmm. a dramatic portrayal in a 5-minute segment of a couple arguing, and then the sermon would wrap it around and say like, this is the sin and whatever it was. And so it was just kind of another artistic way, like music, but in drama, and to, you know, pull people in and keep people interested. It was entertainment.
Do you remember any of those skits? Like
a lot of them were written by Willow Creek, and cause they had kind of, I think, a server where people shared, like people in the Willow Creek Association shared the skits. But I will tell you, like I had family that was really involved in the drama. And so it was like every Thursday night they would go and they would rehearse. And then, you know, I know there was like a Wizard of Oz one, and I'm pretty sure my dad played the Tin Man, if I remember right. So, I mean, it was a whole thing.
It's a fun way to figure out that you like performing or whatever. You know, a lot of kids don't have that opportunity until like high school theater or whatever. So it can be fun. So your podcast with Cortland, initially it was just his podcast, and then he had you on the show, and then you joined it. So I don't know if that's like a Santa Claus situation where now you're going to have to be hosting our show as well. I don't know if that's how it works. But could you explain, like how that came about? And also, you know, you guys had an episode recently, just the two of you talking about purity culture stuff. And it sounds like you and he have very different experiences, with that, or at least I guess you could say different personal, sexual ethics or personal ways of living. But similar in recognizing everybody else's right to have their own sexual ethics and ways of living, right?
Yeah, I would say probably our sexual ethics line up, but our relationship structures are very different right. With our partnerships and everything. But yeah, so Cortland and I met on Clubhouse, which if you're not familiar, it's an app that's live audio conversations, yet another social media. But during the pandemic, it was great because we would connect with people. There was no text, there was no feed, no timeline. And so it was always live conversations. And a friend of mine in Chicago, actually, I didn't know him, now we're friends, but reached out and was like, let's start a Thursday night room, a regular room, and just build community. And it worked. And it was amazing. And it started as Progressive Christians Talk. It became Progressive / Post Christians Talk. And then it became a lot more about deconstruction. But Cortland was in some of those rooms. And we just became friends. And then a while back, I was flying home from somewhere and I flew through Denver and Cortland lives there. And so he came to the airport and we had lunch and he actually had a co-host in his first season, his buddy, Josh, who was great. But Cortland and Josh just kind of decided to part ways after that first season. And so him and I started talking and, you know, I don't even know who expressed interest first, but we kind of were like, it would be cool to collaborate on a project. And it just kind of came out of that we decided to work together on that. So it's been a really great collaboration. And I love he's like kind of has this fierce atheist perspective, but he's probably more spiritual than he lets on. And so I kind of say I have this progressive Christian perspective, but I hold that so loosely. And sometimes I joke that by the end of the podcast, I'll be the atheist and he'll be the progressive Christian. So, and he's like, and you know, he's bi and poly and you know, I'm in a monogamous straight marriage. And so it's just something that we have different perspectives on things, but we hold space for each other's perspectives. And so it's been a really great partnership.
And kind of bringing up, I listened to the episode that Zach mentioned where you guys went in and talked about purity culture and its effects. And maybe before we go deeper into purity culture, we probably should define it. Like there's been a lot of conversation online everywhere, probably especially it seems like the last 5 years of people rethinking this. I mean, there's people that have written books that can kind of be characterized or people have characterized them as purity culture 2.0. There's other people that have written books deconstructing purity culture, but I guess its initial conception, like in the 80s, 90s or wherever, what are we talking about defining just for our audience when we're talking about purity culture? How would you define it, Megan?
Wow, that's a good question. And I think it's hard to define because it was a culture, right? And so really what it was in an effort to maintain this abstinence, the sexual ethic of abstinence, and to kind of spread that to teenagers, there was a lot of inundation with messaging that created a lot of really harmful, shameful, toxic messaging around sex. So it was like, if you've had sex, you're used chewing gum. If you've had sex, every partner that you've ever had sex with is going to be in your bed on your wedding day. And then there was, of course, there were True Love Waits campaigns where people signed purity pledges. I know I did that at a Rebecca St. James concert. And then there was Joshua Harris, who wrote I Kissed Dating Goodbye, who took it one step further and said, you know, instead of just waiting to have sex until you're married, you should actually wait to kiss until you're married, because you know, any physical connection is just, you know, too intimate. And so you should build your emotional connection first and then work on the physical. And so out of that, you see 10 years later, people unpacking that harm, and you see people like Joshua Harris coming back and making a documentary called I Survived, I Kissed Dating Goodbye. And now he's agnostic, I think, and not married anymore. So yeah, so it's just a lot of people unpacking what that era did and then what is still happening, because I think people think it's over and it's not. And I think a huge part that's not in that conversation from the 90s and 2000s about purity culture is what was happening to the queer community and what continues to happen to the queer community in this new purity culture. Because in my opinion, I think what I got as a straight woman, as a cis straight woman, was like purity culture light. And I think what's happening to the queer community is like purity culture pro.
Yeah, it was, I like how you described it, because most of evangelicalism is conservative, but there was kind of a mainstreamness to purity culture. And that was the True Love Waits campaign. I participated in that. I signed a pledge as well in the 90s. And there was definitely the expectation of the Christian ethics or the Bible wants you to wait until you're married to have sex. And that's kind of the mainstream view. But then, like you said, you know, Joshua Harris comes along, and then all of a sudden it's keeping your emotions pure. And then suddenly people are doing like really creepy things, like dating their daughter. And you had purity rings, purity balls, where a dad would go with his daughter to prom or something of that nature. That was never in the circles that I ran in per se, but I definitely heard of that being out there for sure.
I tried to take advantage of it. My parents got my sister a purity ring.
There you go.
And I was like, there's not, you know, they don't do rings for boys. So come on, what do I get? Like this ring's not, I mean, it was probably a very cheap ring, but, but I was like, it's jewelry, you know? So it's like worth something. So Pentium computers had just been released, and I asked if I could get a purity Pentium, and they just sort of laughed and were like, ah, you'll be fine.
It's, you know, funny,
as long as you keep the shame up, you'll be fine. You know, I was not ignored. You know, it was not the like everything is on girls here. Like, I definitely had a lot of responsibility put on me, but I didn't get any gifts for it.
Yeah. Well, I will say, I'm glad you said that, because I know you're kidding around, but I think a big part of purity culture that I left out is the very gendered roles, right? And so it was just this very like, women should wait to be pursued, men should be this spiritual leader that, you know, and so it was that whole messaging too is something that I still unpack. So,
yeah. And that turned, that messaging really turned into, you know, again, there's the creepy version of a guy would become a stalker because like, oh, I am going to pursue this girl, even though this girl told me I am only interested in being friends, or was giving vibes like I am not interested in you at all. Well, I'm going to keep pursuing her because I'm going to convince her that.
Because God told him. That's right.
Yeah.
What it was.
And sometimes it got to that kind of a message. And it seems like it just created so much awkwardness between men and women. And like you said, not to mention, you know, the LGBT community trying to fit in there in conservative evangelical Christianity. But I remember back in college and young adult years, especially in college, I used to have conversations going to a conservative Christian college. We used to sit around and talk about why it was always so awkward to be friends with women, with young women. And like, did you find that as well in your circles? Like the people were talking about, why is it so weird? And did purity culture kind of play a role in that, where all of a sudden every single person of the opposite sex, again, if we're cisgendered, if we're straight, is a potential like, oh, this might be quote unquote the one, you know? And so everything just became this like really awkward. I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah, so I have those conversations now. I didn't have those conversations then because I was just had the messaging that you shouldn't be friends with the opposite gender unless it's romantic. But then again, I was told that I shouldn't pursue anything. And so I just, there was a lot there, but I will say now I have a lot of male friends and I have straight male friends, and it is something that was new, and I've tweeted about this and I've talked about this, and it wasn't just like, okay, no longer purity culture, I'm just going to become friends with men and it'll totally be fine. No, it like actually took some work. I had to like have communication with my partner. Like, what are our expectations when we have these kinds of friendships with other people? And then like with my friends, I had conversations around like boundaries and expectations and things like that, that, you know, maybe they didn't need, but I did, or maybe I didn't need, but they did, you know? And so it's just, it does take a little bit of work. But what I found is how much, you know, like I'm enriched by those, by having an ability to be friends with anyone and not limit like who I talk to and who can be in my DMs. And it's also, I feel like, created more space for my voice too, because I'm not limited in who, I'm not just somebody that talks to only women or talks to only straight women. And so it just, it kind of creates space for, hey, I can have connections and I can collaborate on projects with people that aren't my spouse, and I can be close friends with people that aren't my spouse or my partner or whatever, you know? And so I think that is something new that I've had to navigate. But back then I just, you don't have those conversations because you just don't have those relationships.
I always had a lot of friends that were girls. Having a sister just made it a lot easier for me to kind of intuitively not be uncomfortable communicating with them. But as far as any sort of romantic intentions, like my youth pastor's spin on purity culture was he told us that he had decided that he would never say I love you unless he knew the next words were, will you marry me?
Wow.
And I took that to heart. I was like, that is amazing. And I'm totally going to do that. So I never read the Josh Harris book. I didn't avoid kissing. But I guess I avoided emotional honesty. like I remember like dating a girl in college that essentially like she told me like after we broke up, whatever, that like that she figured out that when I'd say I miss you, it meant I love you, but I knew I couldn't say it. And that it always hurt that she could never hear that. And that made me rethink things in relationships after that. Like, yeah, I'm like not saying that to somebody that you supposedly are in a relationship with for, you know, he was just months. He wasn't years, but it was wild. and I wish I hadn't done that. But, you know, I was also, I had a policy generally of like, I'm only going to date somebody as long as I think I might marry them. And as soon as I know that that's off the table, boom, done. You know, going to Mars Hill, it was a competition. It was, you know, you get married early, the good girls are going to get taken by the godliest men with the best jobs. So you gotta make it happen. You gotta step up. You gotta pursue, and then don't do anything at all until you're married. Yeah. And when you are married, you have to be an absolute horn dog.
Starting on the wedding night.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And if you're not, there's something terribly wrong with you. Because you know, Mark was going to tell us like how often he had orgasms, like from the stage. So we like know what normal is. It's how often he has sex, you know?
Yeah. Which he would say daily. He would say that as an expectation.
Right. Yeah. I mean, he would say, you know, if it's been like 48 hours, my wife knows that it makes me go a little nutty, you know? So she knows to help take care of that, you know? Yeah. The purity culture showed up in a lot of different ways there.
Do you remember when Mark used to say quips like, yeah, she's hot, but so is hell, which he did multiple times. Did he do that while you were there?
Yeah, I don't remember that one.
Yeah.
oh, trying boy. To forget that's a, so much yeah, exactly. of that.
That's a whole other chapter of Mars Hill life. Yuck. Now, we mentioned Purity Culture 2.0. We kind of were talking about the first kind of inception of it, like in the 80s and 90s. But there have been other books coming out, and I'm thinking of, I haven't read any of these books, by the way, but Sheila Ray, Gregoire, Joanna Sawatsky, and Rebecca Gregoire, Lindenbach, I think I got that right, The Great Sex Rescue. And then the other one I think is pretty popular, Rachel Joy Welcher, Talking Back to Purity Culture. And people are referring to this as kind of a 2.0 because, as far as I've heard, they're criticizing certain elements of the original purity culture, but they're still hanging on to a message. Megan, have you read any of those books, or are you familiar with the messaging or the themes that they're going
yeah,
through?
Yeah, so I am definitely familiar. I've read a ton of excerpts from Rachel Joy Welcher's book and had a ton of conversations about that one. And then Sheila's, I've read some of her blog posts and some of her work. I haven't read her book, but I want to be super clear. Neither of them are affirming to the LGBTQ community. Both of them maintain that the biblical sexual ethic is abstinence until marriage. And we can unpack why I think that's harmful if we want. We don't have to, but and I think the reason that I speak about their work a lot is because they claim to be, I mean, Rachel Joy Welcher's, the title of her book is Talking Back to Purity Culture. And so both of those books claim to be an answer or a solution to the harm of purity culture. And I fiercely believe that they still perpetuate the harm. And I, you know, reading the toxic messaging, I know like Rachel Joy Welcher will say like, if you feel like you're, you know, you might want to masturbate, go take a walk outside, go somewhere where you don't think that that could happen, you know, and things like that. And Sheila will say like, we interviewed, you know, all of these women and found that, you know, this really high percentage of women regrets having sex before they got married and feels a lot of shame about it. And so there's still like, they're trying to say that they're taking away the shame and they're kind of saying like, but you know, you can be redeemed, but yet they're still perpetuating all this shameful messaging about sex and making it seem like, yeah, there's this pure before time and then you get married. And then there's this like after time where, you know, sex is great and welcome and holy and all of these things. And it's like, no. And it makes me really, it makes me angry because it's like a bait and switch. And I'll get people in my DMs that are like, I did feel quite uncomfortable with their work and I didn't realize why until I saw kind of some of the interaction and conversation about it. And I'm like, yeah, it's like very manipulative. So I get pretty fed up about it.
Yeah. I haven't read either of those. Sheila followed me for a bit and I just got real bad vibes when I checked out her stuff. So
she unfollowed you at some point.
I don't know if she unfollowed me. I think I politely followed her and then that lasted like a week or something and then unfollowed. But yeah, so they're saying like purity culture created this whole environment of like shaming people, but also we did a study and people feel shame about this. Yeah. So it must be at least partially right. like, huh, a little chicken egg. And talking back, it's more like in conversation with purity culture. Let's talk about the Bible mandating abstinence before marriage, that the only biblical way to express sexuality is a married man and a woman daily engaging in sexual congress.
Well, man, where do we even begin?
The phrase sexual congress is always...
Well, and I also think, you know, we can talk about that. We can say, yes, it's what evangelicals are saying is abstinence until you're married, if you're straight. And yeah. What they're saying is celibacy for life if you're queer. That's you know, what is the messaging is, whether it's clear or unclear. That's really at the end of the day where it comes from. And so, you know, Cortland and I did a whole episode where we talked about people don't have agency over their own sexual autonomy, you know? And so when it comes to, this is the prescribed ethic that comes straight from the Bible, you're putting something on other people and you're making them feel like, if I can't fit into this box, I'm not godly enough, I'm not whole, I'm not, you know, in God's design. And so if for some reason, if, you know, if they have a partner that they want to have sex with, they feel shame about it. They feel dirty. They feel gross. And it's not this clear biblical thing anyway. And so it's not like, and so it's just, you know, it's just this prescriptive ethic that just came out of, you know, a couple verses here and there where people interpreted them to mean something that's not really there, and then said, if you want to be a good Christian, this is what you have to adhere to. And even, you know, in other conversations that I've had on the podcast with Cortland and other guests, it's so heteronormative too, because it's like, they're really just talking about straight sex, right? And so there's so many other ways to have sex than penetrative sex. And so it's really like, okay, well, like, let's get into that. Or also, it's, you know, like I said, with the whole friendship thing, because I just never had friendships, we just never talked about what those kind of looked like, right? And so because people are told just to never have sex, they're never talked to about what sex looks like. And so the flip side of that problem is you grow up in a world where sex is a dirty word. It's never mentioned. I've had people, I've tweeted out like, when did somebody have this sex talk with you? And I've had people say, nobody did. And I didn't learn about sex until my wedding night, which is super disturbing to think about. Wow. What that might be like.
Oh gosh.
And then you have like a failure to teach consent. So you're creating sexual abusers who never know what consent should look like. And then you're creating a world of victims where you have this hotbed for people to not understand what it looks like to be able to say, wait a second, that's wrong. And that's not okay. And I don't know if I know anybody that grew up in purity culture that doesn't have a story about being touched, being harmed, being abused. And so, I mean, it's just, there's so many problematic things about it, but that's just to touch on a few.
Yeah. At Mars Hill, you know, teaching that, you know, women cannot refuse their husbands when they're in the mood, and that men couldn't masturbate. Stephanie Drury put it, she said that basically just men would masturbate into their wives. That's what it created, which was, you know, a rape culture centered around that.
And I will say too, I just want to add this on, that wasn't unique to Mars Hill. I was in a small group where my small group leader told all the, like, we had men and women separate, and she told all the women, like, you should be doing this, this, and that with your husband on this, and that, how this often. And so while Mars Hill is very problematic, I also don't want people to think that it was like this outlier that, like, you know, it, yeah,
it,
like,
wasn't, it happened. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it definitely was not. Yeah. I think, I mean, I've always liked the term enthusiastic consent. And I think that definitely applies for marriage as well. And that, you know, that should be an important, I guess we're talking about what are the sexual ethics everybody should have. That's the place to start. Enthusiastic consent, right? But in your commentary about the Bible, here's what I find interesting about the Bible. And I love the Bible. I'm a committed Christian. And
I find it very boring. Continue.
That's all right. When somebody says the term traditional biblical sexual ethics, right? Like, think about from Genesis to Revelation, everything that's going on in the Bible. And there's polygamy, and there's Song of Songs where Solomon is sleeping, most scholars think, with a bunch of different women. And then there's this passage, which this should probably come with a trigger warning. This is in Deuteronomy. And this is really rough, but this is a couple of verses. I'll just read this. This is Deuteronomy 21, verse 10, starting there. This is NIV. When you go to war against your enemies and the Lord your God delivers them into your hands and you take captives, if you notice among the captives a beautiful woman and are attracted to her, you may take her as your wife. Bring her into your home, have her shave her head, trim her nails, and put aside the clothes she was wearing when captured. After she has lived in your house and mourned her father and mother for a full month, then you may go to her and be your husband, and she shall be your wife. If you are not pleased with her, let her go wherever she wishes. You must not sell her or treat her as a slave, since you have dishonored her. So, I mean, that's it's really rough. Makes you want to throw up in your mouth a little bit. But when you're talking about a biblical sexual ethic, you're talking about this ancient culture. There are different sexual ethics in the Bible, is what I'm getting at. And culture is a driving force with that over the course of the, 3,000 years, maybe, or 2,000 years that the Bible is written. And I think that's important to keep in mind, not just to do a sermon or a Bible lesson, but, culture is not always a bad thing in determining sexual ethics. And sometimes the Bible comes alongside culture in that way. That's a rough verse.
A biblical sexual ethic considers a wife to be property. So
it did. Yeah. In that ancient culture, yep. You read it as a modern person, and honestly, it should make us sick. Like that's a rough passage. I've heard Rob Bell speak on that passage, and that was a really interesting message. But anyway, beside the point. The point is, there are different sexual ethics in the Bible.
Yeah, this is why I like Tori Douglas's podcast, Go Home Bible, and Justin Gentry, Go Home Bible, You're Drunk. Because mm-hmm. they pick out those passages and they're like, what the fuck?
Yeah, right. It's such a different culture. They didn't have a dating culture like we do. LGBTQ stuff in the Bible, there's probably like four verses in the entire Bible. And even then, it's like, Romans 1 is like lust. So is it talking about like a committed loving relationship? Probably not. There's all kinds of different, if someone wants to believe in the Bible and be a committed Christian, I mean, there's interpretation and hermeneutics is an important thing to do when doing that.
Yeah. So. And I'll be fully honest, because this is a conversation I've had with some people that have wanted to like debate my interpretation of like complementarianism and all of that. And like, when it comes to the hermeneutics of it, I'm like, okay, but when I see that something's causing harm, then I don't need to do, I mean, I have done the deep dive study and read the, different interpretations and how this word could have meant this. And I've seen sermons on it. But when at the end of the day, it's like I see that forcing celibacy on the queer community is literally killing people in the queer community. And I will not I don't need hermeneutics to back up why I'm going to affirm and fully, fully love LGBTQ people as their full selves and not ever question like, well, what is God? No, this is. Like, you are a whole person as you are, and I'm not going to ever argue with you about that. And so I think, for me, I still call myself a progressive Christian, and it infuriates the Theo Bros because they want to have those debates with me. And I'm like, you can tell me that I'm not a Christian. Like, I don't like you have no control over my faith or my label or anything like that. But I'm going to tell you this is harming and killing people. So I am going to push back against this. So,
yeah, when I hear the Bible used to back up harmful positions that hurt people, at this point, it doesn't matter to me whether I think that's what the Bible's clearly saying or not. I'm going to choose to go with what I think is respectful and loving towards people.
Yeah.
So we can spend, and endless hours trying to decipher the meaning in a few verses and try to discern what the authors of the Bible were exactly intending. But I'm going to say, hey, trans people are people. and they deserve to love and be loved. All LGBTQ people are people and deserve that. And I don't need the Bible to answer that question for me anymore.
I think some of our audience, and maybe if we have evangelicals still listening out there, one of the youth group tropes was always like, well, how far can I go? You know, but to ask a question a different way, like what sexual ethics should we all have? Do you think we talked about enthusiastic consent? Is that the only one, or is there other ethics that we should consider as well, whether we're Christians, progressive Christians, agnostics, or wherever we're at on the spectrum?
Well, first, I just have to say that my youth pastor coined the phrase denim sex, and he denim, preached like jeans? Against that. And so that might be something we could unpack on a different episode, but denim sex. That, and I just remember getting in the car with my mom and her turning to me and be like, I've never heard that phrase, denim sex. Have you? And I'm like, I don't know if this is a conversation I want to have with my mom. But anyway, so sexual
ethics. Does that just mean grinding?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think, like, is that a particular move?
I think that was quite a notorious and common practice on Christian college campuses.
No idea what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Well, and clearly, if my mom didn't know either, and he probably should have defined it. But anyway, so you mentioned enthusiastic consent. I usually try to add in communication, like having all parties just really be in the know about what the expectation is here. And then, you know, without harm. And so being safe about it and, you know, understanding what is happening. And so a lot of education. So, but yeah, my baseline, I've always had consent and communication. And then I, you know, as I've had conversations, I've had that come up like, well, and also like, let's add the without harm. And I'm like, yes, of course that, you know, and it's funny because in my mind, I'm like, oh, that's obvious. But yet I do think being very clear about things is really helpful. So that's where I'm at. And it's so funny because you see these deconstruction hot takes that people say, like, well, progressive Christians or people that are deconstructing just want to have a lot of sex.
Yeah.
I like my sexual ethic has changed dramatically in the last couple years. And yet I haven't had sex with any more people than I was having sex with before. Like it's just me and my partner, you know, and it's like, so it's just funny because what I affirm and validate and advocate for has changed a lot, but not because I'm like trying to go out and have sex with more people. So I just think it's wild that people think that like, I'm just trying to change the definition for, you know, some whatever reason. And I'm like, no, I just am understanding what causes harm and what doesn't cause harm.
Yeah, I think the Gospel Coalition is going to be really disappointed in you to find out that the slope wasn't as slippery.
Yeah.
But yeah, it does seem like it's, you know, anecdotally, like it's more the opposite way around is what they're saying. They're saying, okay, so basically you got Christians and they're looking around. They're like, gosh, darn it. I want to have more sex with more people. How do I figure out how to do that? I'm going to Google more sex. Oops, I'm a Christian. Ah, there's this thing called deconstruction. Okay. So if I just like deconstruct, then I can like, you know, get a one-way ticket to Horntown and it'll all be good. And it seems more that it's people have various reasons for deconstructing, whether it be, you know, trauma or just normal doubts that they linger on a little bit more and read more and study and come to conclusions. And, you know, everybody has all these reasons, but along the way of deconstructing, frame of references are expanded. They learn more about other people and why the so-called biblical sexual ethic is less grounded in the Bible than they were told. And I think it's sort of the expansion of one's sexual ethic follows the deconstruction, and it's not the impetus to deconstructing.
Yeah.
But it, I mean, but once you realize,
once you realize that the rules about Christian living have been taught from an interpretation of the Bible, then it's like, okay, everything, like I need to kind of sift through everything. And that becomes one of the things, right? But I want to say too, that I have friends that were single for a long time and didn't get married, right? You know, young, out of college or whatever. And so got married in their late 30s, early 40s, and they had sex and didn't feel shame about it. And they just like, they changed their sexual ethic because they were like, well, that doesn't make sense anymore. And I'm like an adult and I can, you know, choose and have autonomy. And I think about, you know, you see these youth pastors that are grooming high school students to become their wives. And there's this whole, like, just get married, like just, you know, it really encourages that kind of mentality of like get married young, get married fast, get married quickly, you know, and so there's so many different avenues of how this causes harm, right? And it's celebrated. So like, there's like an Instagram post, I don't know if you've seen it going around, of a pastor that has a post of his girlfriend. He's a youth pastor. And he has a post of his girlfriend with like balloons that spell out 18 or say, you know, the not spell, but the numbers.
Yeah.
And because she turns 18 and then they can date. And it's like, they've been dating all this time. And and since she was 14 and you're like, that is child abuse. Like, and
yeah, he's the director of that film 2025. That's like a dystopian vision of a future when, you know, COVID crackdowns have gone crazy or something, an authoritarian government is cracking down on Christianity or whatever, you know, the common persecution fever dream stuff. You know, apparently his future doesn't crack down on super pervy youth pastoring. Yeah, that was incredibly gross. Yeah, because he talks and like, yeah, you know, it after like 4 or 5 years of dating, it's nice that she's finally 18. They can get married.
Yeah. Well, and I've tweeted about this before. So when I was like 16, I met a friend on AOL and he was like, he's not a Christian. And he worked at McDonald's and lived across town and picked me up in his BMW and got me some free French fries. And I totally
worked at McDonald's and drove a BMW.
Yeah. I don't know how it all worked out. Okay. Don't ask questions.
All right.
I'm just kidding. But anyway, it was an old BMW.
All right.
So we would like ride around town and hang out and I had a crush on him and nothing ever happened. And he was like 19 and he went to a community college and he was listening to like Marilyn Manson and Nine Inch Nails. And he was kind of like the bad boy. He didn't go to church and
kind of,
I didn't really like and then nothing happened between us, right? And so then like years later, like a few years later, we reconnected. I had like just finished college. We were hanging out and I was like, can you tell me why like 6 years ago when I was 16 and I had a crush on you and we would hang out, like nothing ever happened? And he's like, yeah, because I was 19 and that, like, I'm not a creep. And I was never taught, like, I never knew that when I was 16. Like, I didn't know that there was like, you know, the 18-year-old thing and the all of that. Like, I just did not know that. And so it's wild to me that like there's situations like I went to a party when I was in high school and I totally got groped and I like walked away from that feeling so much shame. Like, I hope my parents don't find out that this guy like felt me up and because like I don't want to get in trouble. And there was no sense of like, no, hold on. Like, I hope you know that it, like, you have autonomy over your body and people shouldn't be touching you. And that is okay. And when somebody does touch you, it's an abusive situation and it's an assault situation. And so I think, you know, you have this lack of education and you have these people in school board meetings saying like, don't ever teach, you know, our kids anything. And it's like, what we're trying to do is teach consent. Like, I used to teach, I'm sorry, I'm on my soapbox, but I will say this. I used to teach first grade. And if anybody knows, like little kids, you have those shirts that like, they have the sequins that go up and down and they like make a picture when you like brush them up and then they make another picture when you brush them down. Mm-hmm. And I would teach my kids, my students consent. Cause I would say like, it's not okay to just walk up to your friend and just like rub their chest. Like, that's just not. And so I'm like, if you want to see what that those sequins do, ask them to show you. Like, you can't just like put your hands on someone. And that's the kind of shit we're trying to teach our kindergarten and first graders, not sexual positions like people think, you know? And so I just, the lack of education is so damaging, because then people grow up and have these situations and they're taught like, well, it was my fault because I wore the tank top. I was wearing revealing clothing. And so I'm the one that should feel shame about being groped at a party or whatever it is. So
I am so sorry that happened to you. And I, you know, for anybody out there, like if somebody that you're relatively attracted to is walking down the street naked, you still have autonomy to not touch them, to not harass them. That is all on me as a guy or somebody. Like, you just don't do it. That's the ethics that we should all abide by, you know? I mean, so it's not about what somebody's wearing. It's about controlling yourself.
Yeah, I feel like I didn't really hear the word consent at all until college, maybe. And, you know, I went to public high school, but, you know, I think a lot of the sex ed stuff is junior high. You know, my dad put on the Dr. Dobson tape in the car and that was the extent of the conversation. And
all right, you gotta give us that. You've done it before on the show, but you gotta give us the Dobson, the famous Dobson quip.
Do you have an impression? Is that?
No, I have a quote of an impression. So when I was 15, I went to the Christian Booksellers Association National Conference. My dad went every year. Their store was basically a worship leader supply store. They had relationships with all the publishers and things, but they weren't selling like pop music. It wasn't like a Lifeway sort of thing. And that year it was in Anaheim. So he was like, hey, you should come with me this year. We can go to Disneyland in the evening, whatever. So I did that, you know, met a bunch of executives from various Christian publishing companies and got to meet Dean Jones from the Herbie movies and various other 70s Disney stuff. He had a memoir that was out then. But yeah, there we saw a Christian stand-up comedian named Paul Aldrich, and he did an impression of Dr. Dobson. And all it was he just said, puberty. And the entire audience just died because everybody had heard that tape and heard him say puberty. And it could only work there. So yeah, it's been seared in my brain ever since, just puberty. But yeah, no, I didn't hear consent. It was just control your body by doing nothing. Mm-hmm. And eventually you'll have a reason to learn a thing or two. But good luck. Oh, and now the internet exists. Let's pretend it doesn't.
Yeah.
So, oh my goodness.
So like, you know, like, many kids ever since I got most of my education from the internet and from reading Savage Love.
Well, I think we are coming about to the end of our time here with Megan. Thank you so much for sharing with us and sharing your thoughts. Before we go, are there maybe resources, books, things that have helped you heal from purity culture, heal from some of the shame and guilt that you want to talk about for people who may be listening out there?
Yeah, I would say the book Pure by Linda K. Klein is a resource I recommend a lot. Sex, God, and the Conservative Church by Dr. Tina Sellers. #Church2 by Emily Joy Allison. There's so many podcasts and folks out there talking about purity culture. And a lot of what I've learned has been from what's out there. I know there's Brenda Marie Davies from God is Gray, Jamie Lee Finch. And then there's a lot of people in the queer community, Matthias Roberts. And so I have a resource list that I don't know if you guys have show notes. I can send it over and you can drop it in the show notes.
Sure. That'd be great.
That's been floating around Twitter. That's helpful because it's it has some diverse voices there. And so, yeah, there's a lot out there.
I've been trying to find a book on purity culture that's really that covers a lot of the male experience of that. And so many of the books that I've found have been really specifically about women's experience in that. And, you know, I think they bore the brunt of it.
So go follow, if you don't already, go follow the Snarky Gent on Twitter. He is a very good friend of mine. A very good friend of mine. I'm trying to get him to write a book about the male experience. Cause he said the same thing. And if you see him talking about purity culture, he is able to unpack the harm in a way that just really targets, like, this is what the theology is and this is what is harmful about it. And he'd be a good follow.
I just followed him just now. I recognize the picture. So, I've come across him. We haven't talked about the elephant in the room isn't the phrase, I suppose. Well, I mean, the djembe was the elephant in the room, but but we gotta touch a little bit on the ex-evangelical CCM karaoke night.
Oh yeah.
This, I mean, saying epic, I sound like a 15-year-old that's already not cool, but I think it was an epic evening. Can you talk a little about what that was and how it came about and how good my performance was?
That was an amazing night. I mean, like, how much time do we have? Like,
Dave didn't get to see any of it. He's jealous. Is there any recording of any of that?
I actually was truly very jealous. I wanted to be there. And Megan put it on with Kevin Nye, who has a...
Yeah, I had to talk to a friend because I was like, I have no idea if, like, the levels, if anybody could hear the music as I was playing or if they could only hear me doing my Michael W. Smith impersonation or whatever. Folks can, I think the name is pretty self-descriptive. There was a night, a Zoom evening of ex-evangelicals.
I mean, Kevin and I was like, we should open a bar where it's just CCM karaoke, and people were like, oh my god, we should.
And
I think we had no idea, because Kevin and I are like both pretty progressive and post-evangelical, and so we were like, I hope people understand, like, we want to create a space where people can belt out these songs and appreciate them, but like, and not, you know, and not be troubled by the toxic lyrics, like somebody saying DC Talks, I don't want it. Speaking of purity culture.
That was my highlight of the night for sure.
Yeah. And so, but I mean, and then like John Steingard from Huck Nelson popped in and Derek Webb popped in. And honestly, like talking, John and I are pretty good friends, and talking to John, like there has not been a place to appreciate that music for him. Like he would, I mean, if you were there, he was like, I had to borrow a guitar. I haven't even picked up a guitar. I haven't sang in so long. And it was very special, I think, for the artist, but also for all of us. It was very healing because that music, like I had not listened to it in so long. And then I was able, it was like, it broke this wall of like, okay, I can listen to this and appreciate this. And like, also not be flooded with the toxicity of some of this stuff. And then Derek emailed me the next day, and maybe your listeners are getting like a special reveal, but he was like, that was amazing. And I have names of people that I want to bring next time. So, there might be people that we could, he was like, I don't know, maybe like Jen. And I'm like, oh, like, do you call Jennifer Knapp Jen? Like, I love that, you know? And so there's talks of one, maybe next month, maybe April, but it was a very beautiful night. And I mean, it was like, super, I don't know, cathartic. 3 or 4 hours. It was amazing. So yeah.
That is so cool. Yeah. And I mean, for any listeners, if they do it again and Derek Webb says he's going to bring people, this is one of the former lead singers of Caveman's Call. So he is probably really well connected, right? Like, yeah, we'll see who he might bring.
Cool. Did you sing anything? Did I miss it? Or
me?
Did you just MC the night?
Yeah, it was a whole joke because I don't sing. I mean, remember djembe? Like, I don't sing.
Yeah.
I don't sing either. I don't think I get to play the djembe. So, I mean, I'm like way far. I mean,
nobody had to prove down. They could sing to sign up for it. Like,
no,
there was a wide range.
That day, I took a video of myself singing one of Jennifer Knapp's songs and put it out as a promo. And it was really bad. It was hilariously bad. I have it on Twitter if you want to look it up. It's really off key, but I'm like rocking out with like my headphones and my mics. They look like I'm like really cool and in you know, my office studio, right? But no, I don't sing.
Well, I don't know. You may need to practice. If you're in charge of this whole thing and there's going to be follow-up ones, I don't know. You may need to just, you know, find something that's in your range. Or you know what? Here's the deal. I got it. You do Witch's Invitation or Satan Bite the Dust. You do one of those Carmen talking songs, you know? You don't have to sing a note. It's just a narrative.
Yeah. No, I don't know. Maybe I'll bring my djembe next time.
There you go.
Carmen's right. A whole other thing, man. That's a whole other level. Carmen.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I don't think anybody did any Carmen that night. Yeah, as far as like being able to enjoy these and get beyond the toxicity of the lyrics, I think it's kind of impossible to do that with Carmen. There's just every line's a landmine there.
Okay, so. But you know who I think still kind of slaps? Did you ever listen to Grits? They were pretty cool.
Oh, I love Grits.
Never heard of them.
As a matter of fact,
I was pretty much done in like 95.
Yeah, no, they have some banger songs. As a matter of fact, I just listened to a Good Christian Fun podcast episode where they did, what's the name of that song? It's a really famous song. Been featured in several.
Song?
Yeah, been featured in several movies. Let's see. I have it right here.
I mean, I'm very close to rapping right now, but I won't.
Oh, yeah. It's Ooh Ah. It's the, yeah. Yeah, it's been in like Big Mama's House. It's, yeah.
It was in the movie Big Mama's House?
Big Mama's House with Martin Lawrence. If I've never seen it, but.
I have not seen it either, but I'm familiar with it.
It's a good. I like that song. Yeah, but
oh, they have other good.
Is that
ones.
A crossover hit or?
Yeah. Oh,
just
totally.
The LCCM soundtrack. It was on Big Mama's House.
Yeah, it was on hip hop stations.
Zach, you're going to be jamming tonight.
Oh yeah.
Okay.
Hooking up with some grits.
Look up grits.
Kobe
also, I just I want to name the fact that like here I'm a white girl recommending this like really cool. You know, hip hop songs. So just take that for what it's worth. Cause I also used to play the djembe. So I just want, you know, just know what you're getting here.
It's all good. I play guitar on a couple of records that came out on a hip hop label. So, but that's another thing.
That's really cool though.
Yeah. You know, it's neat. Okay. Well, Megan, we booked this like a month ago and then we've been super chatty ever since. And then we kind of met on the karaoke night and we're like, we still like two more weeks until we get to talk or whatever. And it's so nice for it to finally happen. And I'm sorry if you were expecting a super structured conversation.
No, that's great. This
we don't
have
do
any time.
Write another book and then we can do it like that. I'll have bullet points. I'll have everything.
I could give you the book I have now and you would find plenty to talk about. Like, wow, the prayer of Jabez really meant that to you.
Ooh.
Oh, boy.
have you thought of writing another book or?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I have some ideas percolating.
Okay, cool. And that can kick off your next deconstruction.
Yeah, there you go.
All right. Well, thank you for coming on the show. And we'll keep listening to the Thereafter podcast. And there's lots of good resources at your website, thepursuinglife.com. And I'm sure we'll keep talking on Twitter as well.
Yep, for listeners on Twitter.
Thank you so much.
At Pursuing Life on Twitter.
The Pursuing Life,
So great to meet you. Thank you. Thank you for coming on.
Yeah.
Well, Dave, I don't have a prepared statement. Dave.
Dave.
Oh, you got something?
I have a prepared statement. You have some homework from the last episode that we created with Jeffrey Overstreet. And you said you were going to watch the movie Don't Look Up. And I predicted you would give it two stars, and I was wrong. And this feels like a good time to bring this up again, talking about purity culture, because I think your movie purity was defiled, if I am not mistaken.
I thought you meant the manner in which I watched it. I watched Don't Look Up. I even tried to have something of a big screen experience. I watched it in my room where I have a projector screen. It's not a fancy projector or whatever, but it was bigger than just the TV. And I really aggressively disliked it. It was one of those, like, I can't believe this is an actual movie sort of experiences, where it just seems like they misfired with just about everything. Mm-hmm.
What about Timothy Chalamet's character?
He was maybe the high point. He was just sort of playing himself. It seemed like, you know, just very casual, whereas everybody else was a far more heightened performance. And I just felt like every creative choice that was made was wrong. Just like tonally, editing. And I did find it weird. I feel like they're just sort of, okay, so this is a personal taste issue, I suppose. But is it just me, or like, is it weird that the movie had Leonardo DiCaprio's character treated as being like hunky? Because I feel like he has not really aged gracefully, and is meant to look kind of disheveled and non hunky in general in this, but it seemed like because it was Leo DiCaprio, there's just like this assumption that everyone is attracted to him.
Right. He's able to have an affair with this celebrity news anchor or whatever kind of that's when it really started to go off the rails for me.
It felt like that was something that would have worked like 10 years ago and just kind of doesn't now. And they were, I don't know.
Yeah, the whole media stuff about it was really, really annoying. When it started going into just, I guess, the attempt at media satire, and then it just went on forever.
That just bothered me because I just felt like the movie's sense of who the characters are seemed very different from me as a viewer's sense of who the characters are.
Interesting.
And that was just one way in which that showed up, but. Yeah, I've seen it. So now the only Best Picture nominee I haven't seen is King Richard. I'll try to see that soonish, I guess. Yeah, well, we started recording this like half an hour after Russia started apparently bombing Ukraine. There's explosions in Kiev. And so I hope this episode comes out before World War III. I hope that we're around to do more episodes, that this doesn't escalate into use of nuclear weapons or whatever. Things are scary, and so I just want to acknowledge that over the next few days things may get a lot scarier between the time that we record this and that this comes out. So if you're scared while you're listening to this and it's weird to hear us joke around about anything, this is me acknowledging that I'm scared too.
Yeah, I second that. We are recording this on Wednesday, February 23rd, and yeah, I just pulled up the headline here. Russia attacks Ukraine. So it's pretty much all out there in the mainstream media. I think they're talking about additional sanctions. What a scary time. And, you know, we hope for peace very soon. Don't know if that'll happen.
I shared this on Twitter, but just like Putin is a guy that fundamentally has such different motivations than any of us are going to have about anything, and different ways of thinking about things. He is really I'm looking this up. If you haven't read Timothy Snyder's The Road to Unfreedom and you want to understand some more about what's going on with Russia, read that. So Putin's super into this philosopher, Gumilev is the last name. I have a screenshot that I took of a page there. I don't remember his first name, but really into this guy, like single-handedly, like brought his writings back into sort of Russian mainstream thought. And among other things, Gumilev taught and believed that human sociability was generated by cosmic rays, and that the generation of each nation could be traced to a burst of cosmic energy, which began a cycle that lasts for more than 1,000 years. And the West is already dead because their cosmic rays happened way more than 1,000 years ago. But Russia, luckily enough, their nation arose from cosmic emissions that happened on September 13th, 1380, making it a young and vibrant nation. So if that sounds insane to you, it is. And these are the sorts of things that are driving the leader of Russia, who is probably the wealthiest man in the world and has nukes. So you got me. What happens next? No idea. But it's super messed up and scary.
Yeah. My goodness. So, well, on that very somber note on what's happening in the world, this has been another episode of Veterans of Culture Wars. If you want to check us out on Twitter, we have a show Twitter at VCWPod. Zach is at Muzach, M-U-Z-A-C-H. I am at Dave J. Lester. You can go to Zach's website, muzach.bandcamp.com, and hear some of the albums and music that he has put out. Music and Logo by Zach.
Thanks for coming on down. Thanks for everybody for sticking around and continuing to listen to these conversations. We're hoping that they are helpful for you, as they have been for us. Remember, I know I like to joke around, but to be incredibly serious, I got to remind you, as always, that the podcast is free, but you still need to tithe 10%.